Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. So whatever happened to moderates? In politics today, it seems everyone's an ideologue and a compromise is a dirty word. Well, on today's show, we talked to a former Republican leader who says the disappearance of the moderate is becoming a real problem in his party. And then we talk with a genius. The MacArthur Foundation has announced this year's genius grants, and one of the 24 who've been recognized as an exceptionally creative individual is from the University of Michigan. We'll speak with her later in the hour. But first, the Michigan legislature is considering bills that would overhaul auto insurance in the state. There are several aspects to this, so to help us wade through what's proposed, we have Jake Nair with Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Lester.
Let's start with what we have right now. Michigan's auto insurance rates, averaged out across the state, are not the most expensive in the nation, although some people believe so. I believe we're the ninth highest in the U.S., but we have the best coverage in the nation. Michigan's auto insurance coverage means if you're badly hurt, after your health insurance runs out, your auto insurance covers your health care costs without limit. That means you can be rehabilitated and so forth. And for the most seriously hurt, that can run into millions of dollars. So, Jake, earlier this year, Governor Rick Snyder and some legislators suggested we cap that coverage at $1 million. That's much higher than the next highest coverage state, which caps it at $50,000. Where is that legislation?
Well, like many other times this has been tried, I think you can say decades now. I believe it got out of committee and then just sat on the House floor forever. It's still there. It sounds like that specific proposal, even after a number of committee hearings and a lot of media attention, it isn't going to move forward at this point. At least that's how it seems.
Yeah, that $1 million cap sounded reasonable to a lot of people. And then they heard family after family and victim after victim who burned through $1 million in no time. Did the legislators, were they basically persuaded by these folks who said, yeah, $1 million isn't going to do it?
Lester, I think this is one of those situations where the governor put it out there. It sounded like the leadership in the legislature wanted to do something on this. But really, for all intents and purposes, at least from my perspective, this was kind of dead on arrival. Like I said, even though they held some pretty high-profile committee hearings on this here in Lansing, you know, almost immediately once this was proposed, we had a number of Republicans, a lot of them coming out from Oakland County in the legislature, in the House, I should say, saying on record that they would not support something like this. And so, you know, really, I don't think the votes were ever there in the state House to get this passed. Obviously, no one wants to be on the – well, at least no one's really eager to be on the opposite side of testimony where you have a paraplegic or a quadriplegic person saying that you're trying to put me in a nursing home, basically, or you're trying to push me onto health plans that just won't work for me and will compromise my health. Those aren't the kinds of things that people are, again, too eager to be on the opposite side with. But again, I think that there isn't a whole lot of will, at least in the state house, to really get anything done on this.
Now, we hear that, as you mentioned, we see this legislation pop up again and again. But the real reason auto insurance rates are so high in Michigan have more to do with theft and fraud and vandalism, especially in some urban areas, and the great number of people who are not carrying auto insurance on their vehicles. Of course, that's mostly because the rates are so high. So what is the legislature doing to deal with these issues behind the higher cost of auto insurance?
Well, it's interesting. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, Michigan, as far as most numbers and most people would suggest, is not the highest auto insurance rates, does not have the highest auto insurance rates in the nation. But what a lot of attention has been paid to is that if you move from one area of the state to another area of the state, Detroit is a very good example, your auto insurance rates could skyrocket.
Quadruple in some cases, yeah.
Exactly. And so you have situations where it's a serious, serious disincentive to, you know, move into places. And a lot of those places are areas where you would want to incentivize people to move to so that there's a broader tax base. But an interesting thing came up, you know, in the Senate, where Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville has said that even though the measure that was brought up in the House is seriously stalled and looks like won't get anywhere, that the Senate might look to bring something up on no fault this fall. And it sounds to me like he is also interested in capping the coverage for no fault for people who get injured. But he's also sort of hinted that instead what we could do is concentrate on the things, like you mentioned, like fraud and so forth, that more people could support. I mean, it seems to me like that you could get a broad base of support for something like really trying to cut down the amount of fraud in the system, people who are collecting benefits that shouldn't be, and that could get broad bipartisan support. Of course, the problem with that is that if you take out the things that are more popular from a more comprehensive approach to overhauling no fault, you lose that support possibly from, again, you know, getting anything else done, like putting a cap or, you know, doing a fee schedule or anything like that. It just seems to me like if they try to do something smaller, people who are proponents of doing, like I said, a more comprehensive approach will lose, you know, an argument for something like that.
The trial lawyers who work on these kinds of cases say capping catastrophic care will not save citizens money because it'll end up bankrupting families of accident victims. They'll end up on welfare and Medicaid, and more cases will end up in lawsuits, which will clog up the courts, which was the very reason Michigan went to no-fault insurance to begin with, to stop all that expensive litigation. So is anybody in the legislature talking about those aspects?
I think the interesting point that you're getting at here is that, to me, if proponents of overhauling no fault would say, you know, if they had the argument to say that, you know, no matter who you're talking to, it's clear that this kind of measure would bring down auto insurance, they'd have a much easier time, you know, actually accomplishing something with this. However, you know, it's really depending on who you talk to. Obviously, proponents of this say this will have a tangible impact. People will notice a significant decrease in their auto insurance rates. But then, like you said, there's trial lawyers, there's other groups that say, no, it really won't. So
yeah, there's no guarantee in this legislation that rates will go down and stay down. There's just this assurance by the insurance companies that, oh, yeah, it'll cost you less. But, you know, if you really want to do something like that, these trial lawyer advocates say maybe you ought to regulate the auto insurance and their rates, the administrative costs, their profits and so forth. So has that been tossed around?
Well, and again, I think that that would be a very difficult thing to get through the legislature with the current political environment. I think that when this is really a package of bills or a measure that insurance companies, that auto insurance companies really want and are pushing for. So, you know, throwing in something that they would clearly not be too happy about might not work for them or for politicians that want to pass something here. So, you know, clearly it's one of those things that is just a very, very heavy lift in Lansing on either side. And, you know, I think it's sort of interesting. You have Google now, you know, trying to they're doing these projects that are just seemingly impossible. Like, I believe Google is now trying to solve death. And I think that's sort of this can be sort of likened to that in a lot of ways, where you have Republicans trying to get something huge done when they're term limited and when, you know, you have things like larger things like Medicaid expansion done and road funding sort of tabled for now, looking to try to get something huge out there. it's one of those things that gets proposed and no one really expects at this point that it's going to get through. Although, if you would have said you know, something similar about Michigan becoming a right-to-work state a few years ago, you might be surprised to find out how that turned out. So, you know, you can never make any assumptions when it comes to the legislature, I suppose.
We do see this auto insurance overhaul coming up again and again. And it seems like the chairs of the committee over that kind of legislation, Senator Joe Hewn and Representative Pete Lund, keep bringing it back up. And when I talk to them, they use exactly the same language as I hear from the auto insurance lobby. Is this something that the lobbyists are encouraging these legislators to keep bringing back?
Well, of course, the auto insurance companies would like to see something like this happen, and that's no secret. I mean, they've definitely been coming out to the committee hearings and have been speaking to legislators who you know are sympathetic to something like this and to their causes, and yeah, that's how legislation is passed up here in Lansing.
Okay, Jake, thanks very much. That's Jake Neer with the Michigan Public Radio Network. Have a good day.
Thanks, Lester.
Oh, and we had to tell you about this. The Detroit City Council will be considering a way to keep all those vacant lots in the city trimmed. Sheep and goats. Now, this is not a new idea. It's been done before in Chicago and in Cleveland. The Environment Report found a vineyard that used lambs to prune grapevines. And during World War I, President Wilson brought a flock of sheep to trim the White House grounds because it was cheaper. Of course, in Detroit, there are some livestock bans that would prevent the grazing. So the city council will have to chew on that. Still to come, the inspiration behind a Michigan-based composer's first major orchestral composition. That story in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The MacArthur Foundation has announced its Genius Grants. 24 people who the foundation wants to recognize as exceptionally creative individuals who already have a track record of achievement and the potential for even more significant contributions in the future. One of those 24 is Susan Murphy, a professor of statistics at the University of Michigan. She joins us now. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I understand your work is developing new ways to evaluate and customize treatment for people with chronic or relapsing disorders such as substance abuse and depression. Now, I don't immediately associate statistics with better health care and treatment, so tell me a little bit about your work.
Well, one of the things we want to do is we want to use data-based evidence to inform how we can best sequence treatments. And when I say best sequence treatments, I mean provide sequences of treatments that really help people overcome their illness. And so one way to use data is to construct clinical trial designs which allow us to investigate the sequencing of that treatment and then to figure out how to analyze that data once the trial is over.
So tell me about a specific example of what you've been working on and how that works.
I can tell you about an example involving little kids. These are children with autism. They're 5 years old, at least 5 years old, and they are still nonverbal. And this is, it's really important for these little kids to learn how to communicate because that is predictive of later success in their life. So the goal of this particular trial was to develop a sequence of treatment which would help the kids learn how to communicate, even though at age five they're still nonverbal. And in this particular case, they considered different types of interventions as the first intervention. One intervention was working with their verbal skills in a play-type environment. Another intervention utilized a device that looks a lot like an iPad, and the child would press buttons on this device, and then it would speak for the child. And one question is, do you need to start using this device earlier on, or can you delay? Maybe some of the children will do well with these with a lower cost intervention, an intervention in which they learn themselves verbally to speak.
So the bottom line here is you're using your research and data to improve the lives of a lot of people who need a bit of help.
Right. That's exactly it.
Now, the MacArthur Fellowship grant, I want to ask you, were you expecting the call from the MacArthur Foundation?
No. I've never even aspired to receiving this award. It seems so out of reach for a statistician. So it was wonderful when I received the award.
So what was your reaction?
I was standing up. I went to answer the phone, and I was standing up. I answered the phone. They tell me that I've won this award, and I sit on the floor. I'm so surprised. And then I don't sleep for the next two nights.
The MacArthur Fellowship grant has increased to $625,000 over a five-year period, and it's a no-strings-attached grant. Any idea how you might use the money?
Oh, I know exactly how I'm going to use it. We're working now on sequences of interventions that can be provided using your smartphone to help you maintain behavior change. For example, if you're trying to lose weight or keep your weight off, how to help you keep that weight off, or if you're addicted to a drug and you're trying to stay off that drug, how can little strategies or a little coach application on the phone help you combat any kind of craving you might have, the stressors that go on in your life? All of this involves sequences of small interventions that we might provide to someone in real time.
Well, you need to get to that research in a better car, too, I think, maybe.
I ride my bicycle to my research.
Oh, good for you. Well, congratulations again. Susan Murphy is a professor of statistics at the University of Michigan and has been named one of the 24 MacArthur Fellows announced today, also known as the Genius Grants. Again, so much. We're so happy for you.
Thank you very much.
When was the last time you got a handwritten note in the mail, or the last time you wrote a note in cursive? The recently approved Common Core curriculum does not include a requirement to teach children cursive. And that's prompted a question. Do we need cursive, or is it merely an antiquated writing style that's not all that useful anymore? Here to talk about that is Jerry Conte. She's a neuroscientist and occupational therapist and an assistant professor at Wayne State University. So it sounds as though school districts can drop cursive in favor of something else, maybe make time for, I don't know, a keyboard class. Or is this an opportunity for schools to actually teach something that might be more useful, or do you see it that way?
I think there are a number of advantages to cursive handwriting, but there is also a need to teach, for example, computer keyboarding, since that is certainly what is commonly used today. There are advantages to doing cursive handwriting, so I'm very much in favor of continuing it in some way during the curriculum.
My second grade teacher, Mrs. Cooper, not only taught us cursive, but she really emphasized penmanship. And judging from the writing I see these days, that's a pretty rare commodity these days with email and Twitter and document software. I'm wondering, why do we need to know how to do anything more than writing quick notes using print or block letters? Why is cursive so important to you?
You know, it may not be really important as adults once we've learned how to do cursive writing, but for our developing students, let's say the first through, there was a survey that said teachers felt fifth grade, but certainly the early elementary grades, that there are a lot of benefits to doing cursive as far as impact on the brain, making it easier for the brain to understand words and language. When we write letters and words, you can see that your hand is moving with the writing. And so you're really using the sensory motor areas of your brain, and that gives input into it. At the same time, you've got visual input, so the vision areas and perception areas of the brain are also working. And as well, of course, we've got the cognitive areas of the brain working. So you've got three areas. Now, if you look at typing the word, think about your finger just going up and down over a keyboard. The finger has no sensory feedback at all. It doesn't know what the letter or the word is. So we lose that third important area of the brain to provide input. So it's a way to help consolidate language skills more quickly for our very youngest students.
It sounds like there's a lot more involved in cursive writing than any of us would have thought as far as cognitive abilities, the learning abilities, and expression. Would you care to predict which way the school districts and teachers will go as far as cursive is concerned in future lessons?
What seems to be the current practice in many schools is, of course, not to include it. The Common Core standards don't say that you can't include it, but you don't have to include it. And it appears that many Michigan schools are not including it or are including it in a worksheet going home to the parents. So in that case, it's really up to the parents to do the practice and the training in cursive handwriting. Some schools in the East have got clubs going with cursive handwriting because it's considered a very cool thing to be doing for students.
Seems like losing centuries of everything from calligraphy to penmanship and even today's hand scratchings, a lot to be lost mm-hmm. there.
The other thing that I'm seeing as an occupational therapist, putting on my therapy hat, is that if you think about writing, how we write is by moving our fingers in very small ways and our wrist in very small ways. When we are just moving our finger up and down, we are losing those fine coordination skills, or what we call dexterity. So our therapists are finding that many of the students are coming in with dexterity skills that are lower than we've seen in past sets of students. So that's also an issue. Again, you would not get that with keyboarding, which is a common thing to do, or gaming.
That's fascinating. That's Jerry Conte. She's a neuroscientist and occupational therapist and an assistant professor at Wayne State University. Thanks for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
So imagine for a moment you're a student, say, at the University of Michigan. You're a music student, and you compose a piece, and suddenly a major orchestra decides to perform your work. Kind of a dream come true, huh? Well, that's the reality for our next guest. That's what he's living right now. Patrick Harlan is working on his Doctor of Musical Arts at the U of M, and his composition, Rapture, will be performed by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra later this month. Welcome. Congratulations. This is a really big deal.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
The St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, if you don't know, is one of the oldest orchestras in the nation. I think the New York Philharmonic is the only one that's older. It was led for years by Leonard Slatkin, a name not unfamiliar here since he's the music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra now. So tell me about this piece. I understand you wrote Rapture after hearing an NPR story.
I did, yeah. I was working on my master's thesis, and I didn't quite know what I wanted to write about. And as I was listening to NPR, I heard an interview about ultra cavers, these guys that spent a month underground. And at some point during that month, they experienced something called the rapture. And they describe it like a panic attack, and it's way more extreme than a panic attack. And I thought this was an interesting concept to work with when writing an orchestra piece.
So how was it reflected in the piece?
So it was reflected in the piece, and then I use only a little bit of material when working on this piece. There's maybe three ideas that I use, and they grow, exponentially. They become more extreme. I stretch them out. I use them for the fabric of the piece later on when there's melodies over the top of it. I didn't want the piece to be something that was about a panic attack. So really, the piece is about an overwhelming sense of emotion.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit of Rapture. That was an excerpt from Patrick Harlan's composition titled Rapture. That work will be performed by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra this weekend. So how did it come about that St. Louis Symphony Orchestra contacted you and said, hey, by the way, that piece you did, we'd like to perform it?
So something that composers do is we tend to go to summer festivals. And I went to a Mizzou International Composers Festival, And the person that funds that, Jean Sinkfield, is also on the board of St. Louis. And it was her idea to select some of those pieces and send them over to David Robertson and have him take a listen. And he did. And he ended up liking a few and programming this one.
David Robertson being the director of music, the conductor
yes,
at St. Louis.
Yeah, right. Correct.
And how'd you get the word?
They emailed me through my website. I actually didn't believe it the first time I saw it. It seemed like kind of...
Thought you were being punked.
I thought I was being punked, yeah. But then I watched, they had a streaming debut or an unveiling of their concert season, and there was my picture with my piece. So that was more confirmation. So.
When you're in the process of writing, how long does it take for you to kind of fully evolve the idea, or does it vary from piece to piece?
Well, it definitely varies from piece to piece, and it's kind of an indeterminate process. So I'll improvise at the piano and come up with ideas that I enjoy or think might work, and then when it comes time to put the piece together or, you know, actually sit down and write the piece, I might have had an idea that's 2 years old that I'm using in a piece. And with this, I think I was sitting down for maybe six weeks or 2 months, somewhere around there, assembling, but some of the ideas are, you know, a year and a half old.
Tell me about the creative process. I mean, do you need a certain space, a certain atmosphere, some frame of mind, or do you need deadlines like I do?
No, deadlines are definitely a good motivator. And as a student, I have to be less picky about my spaces. But at that time, I had just a gigantic room that was open, and I think, you know, it was very beneficial to be working on this piece in.
I want to ask you about the kind of music you listened to when you were younger.
Yeah. So a lot of the time I grew up, I was trained as a pianist. So I played both classically and jazz. Mm-hmm. And so I was inundated with that sort of music. And that's the music that my folks listened to. But I was also equally interested in pop music. And so a lot of the pop electronic stuff is reflected in this orchestra work.
So what do you pull from those influences? I mean, give me an idea of what we will hear in Rapture that would reflect back to that pop electronic beat.
Sure. So I would say that the rhythms in the piece are very electronic. There are rhythms that don't happen in classical music as frequently. And then the harmonic language is jazz. It's definitely where I love to draw from. And then the architecture of the piece is classical. So the way I construct the form, the way the piece evolves or unfolds is something that a jazz piece or an electronic piece wouldn't do, but something that it's very common in a classical piece.
All right, well, let's take a listen to another excerpt from Rapture. I've got to ask you, how old are you?
I'm 29.
And how long have you been composing music?
I've composed as long as I can remember, actually. I composed before I started playing piano. So,
well, this is just amazing to me. Will you be at Powell Hall in St. Louis to hear your work perform?
Yeah, I will. I'll head down next week. There's an excellent rehearsal process you get to sit in as they rehearse your piece and give feedback. So I'll be there.
Yell at the first violinist. And
yeah, the first violinist actually is a teacher at the University of Michigan.
Oh, very good. I also know our friends at St. Louis Public Radio, KWMU, will be broadcasting that performance. So this will be your first broadcast debut, I suppose, too.
This will be my first broadcast debut. That's correct.
So what's next for you? I understand you're headed for the Amazon. Why?
I am headed for the Amazon. Part of my studies at the University of Michigan, I'm a Dow Sustainability Fellow through the Graham Sustainability Institute, and I'm interested in the field of acoustic ecology, and that's looking at the sounds that come from the environment. So I'm headed down to the Amazon to do field recordings and integrate them into my dissertation, which will be an orchestra piece or a chamber orchestra piece. I haven't quite figured that part out, but that utilizes those field recordings.
This sounds like the old composers who listened to nature and made it reflect in the orchestra. That's
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, again, congratulations. Patrick Harlan's composition Rapture will be performed by the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra on September 27th and 28th. Thanks for coming in and talking to us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Still to come, are they on the endangered species list? Of course, we're talking about political moderates. We'll ask former Republican leader Ken Sikkema and Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry whether the moderate is becoming extinct. That's in 15 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. If you work in retail, you probably know the term shrinkage. It's when the inventory you brought into the store disappears. That's often due to shoplifting, sometimes by people outside of the store, sometimes by employees in the store. This spring in Michigan, a new law went into effect that says there's a difference between someone who swipes some lipstick and uses it and someone who steals stuff with the intent to sell it. That law, called the Organized Retail Crime Law, increases the offense from misdemeanor to a felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison or a $5,000 fine or both. Joining us to talk about the new law is Jeff Morinoff. He's a professor in the Department of Sociology and also the director of the Population Study Center and Survey Research Center, both at the University of Michigan. So how much of a problem is this kind of theft from retailers?
Well, retail theft is a problem, and it costs a lot of money to shop owners and business owners every year, and there are also high recidivism rates among this population of offenders. So there's no getting around it. It is a big contribution to the cost of crime.
I was reading the National Retail Federation estimates this problem amounts to billions of dollars a year, something approaching $20 billion, maybe costing shoppers up to $500 a year in increased cost. MLive reported this has become more of a problem because internet services make it easier to sell stolen goods online. So is this new law in Michigan likely to be effective?
Well, it depends on what you mean by effective. If you really think of effectiveness as cost effectiveness, I think it's probably unlikely to be effective. I think that the amount of money that we'll end up spending on the increased corrections costs will far outweigh the gains in terms of what we gain through crime prevention.
Right. I was thinking, you know, in the long run, we all pay for this kind of crime and higher prices on the store shelves, but we also pay for incarceration. We pay for foster care if a single parent is convicted. So I'm wondering what kind of a balance is there here?
The new law takes people who previously would have been prosecuted for misdemeanors and prosecutes them for felonies, making them eligible for incarceration and longer sentences. It costs us roughly $2,300 a month in this country to imprison the average inmate. And when you expand that out to a year, it's about $28,000 per year per inmate. So incarceration is a very costly tool for crime prevention. And most criminologists would agree that even if it's effective at bringing down crime, it's not as cost effective as other remedies.
Let's take a look at a particular case. MLive reported on a pending case, a 26-year-old mother from the Grand Rapids area who was caught shoplifting with her children. She told police she planned to keep some of the stuff for herself and her kids, but then also told police she planned to sell some of the stuff she had stolen. That triggers the new law, right?
That's right. That's the organized aspect of organized retail fraud, where you're being prosecuted for a felony if you have intent to resell.
So in the worst case scenario, we're talking about that $5,000 fine plus a 5-year sentence for this woman. Who knows what happens to the kids? That's a real burden on society. But at the same time, they allegedly stole stuff. I mean, they're accused of taking stuff and they were going to sell it again. There ought to be some kind of punishment rather than just the slap on the wrist.
There definitely ought to be some kind of punishment. The question is, what's the most effective type of punishment? And most of the research on how people get deterred from committing future crime shows that the severity of the sanction or the punishment is not as important as the swiftness and the certainty that punishment will ensue. So just putting people in prison who otherwise might have gotten an alternative sentence like probation is not necessarily going to bring down the crime rate.
We've already been talking about maybe doing away with mandatory sentencing because it's really expensive to put people in prison, as you pointed out. But we've also seen cases like this where we're increasing from a misdemeanor to a felony, and that's automatically going to end up putting more people in prison, depending on how the judges use the law. There's a cost, but at the same time, do we want this society who says, well, look, it's just a small crime. It doesn't matter. When you talk about cost to society, that's one thing, but we want to prevent these kind of crimes as well.
Very true. And I think that there are a number of avenues that you could go down and take the money that you would have invested in increased costs of incarceration to bring down this type of crime. For example, investments in the police has been shown to be far more effective at reducing crime than investments in incarceration per se. Some criminologists who calculate the benefit-to-cost ratio for every dollar spent say that for every dollar spent on the police, you get four in return in benefit for bringing down the crime rate, whereas incarceration is at best a one-to-one or break-even strategy. There's also investments that you could make in early life programs for kids. Childhood education has been shown to have a pretty high benefit-to-cost ratio. And even further, there's also – you can invest in social cognitive skill development, which is a form of rehabilitation treatment.
So you're saying there's a lot of places we could spend this money, get better benefit than throwing someone in jail and paying $28,000 or more for incarceration.
Absolutely. And if I may, another strategy that's been used in other places that makes a lot of sense is one that would increase – the certainty and swiftness of punishment without increasing the severity or length of incarceration. The kind of emblem program out there is one in Hawaii called Project Hope, and it's being practiced by a judge who works with a high-risk group of probationers, many in a drug court, and basically puts them on round-the-clock drug surveillance, drug testing, random drug testing, and anytime somebody tests positive while they're on probation, they will be – there's a very high certainty that they're going to be sent back to prison but or jail, but for a very short stay. And it's these kind of repeated shocks that are very certain and swiftly executed that have been effective at reducing recidivism in this population. Now, who's to say what would happen if that were scaled up to the whole state of Michigan? But that is an example of a deterrence-based program that's a lot cheaper to implement and more effective.
At the same time, the retailers are really concerned about this problem. It costs them a lot of money. As we said, you know, approaching $20 billion across the nation. That's a big hunk of change that they have to deal with. They, the Michigan Retailers Association, gave the legislator who sponsored this legislation a big award saying this is the thing we needed done. So they're applauding this. Are you saying the retailers are a little short-sighted in how they view this crime?
Well, let me caveat what I'm about to say by saying that I haven't read all the remarks from the Retailers Association. But based on what you just said, yes, I would say that they are a little bit short-sighted, that there are other places that they, as an association, could invest their resources, such as business improvement districts, private security, official police law enforcement. All those things would probably be more effective at bringing down the crime rate than increasing the punishment associated with this type of retail fraud.
That's Jeff Morinoff. He's a professor in the Department of Sociology, also the director of the Population Studies Center and Survey Research Center at the University of Michigan, talking about the new organized retail crime law in Michigan. Thanks for the time.
Thank you very much.
Once elected, a politician is to work with colleagues to design policy to help government operate efficiently and serve the people. Since legislators represent different geographical areas of people, they often have to compromise. That's where moderates are key. They are not as steeped in political ideology as hardliners, and they're willing to find common ground that leads to compromise. These days, that sounds rather quaint. Moderates are rare animals. Joining us to talk about that are Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. And Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst. So nearly 20 years ago, fellas, I produced a piece hearing from former U.S. senators about moderates leaving or losing their seats. Since then, that trend has become even more obvious. Ken Sikkema, are there moderates still making a difference in Lansing or in Washington?
Well, I think there are. They probably don't want to call themselves moderates for fear of inviting a primary just by saying that, but I guess I would almost have to call them closet moderates. They are, I think, somewhat paralyzed or fearful of this new Tea Party influence in the Republican Party, at least. But they understand that governing is different than campaigning, and the nuances of governing at the state or national level demand compromise in order to get much done these days.
Jack, I see this political polarization, and I'm wondering, is it just a matter of politics, or is this a reflection of society at large?
Well, it's hard for me to say. I don't know if anyone could really say if it's a reflection of society at large, but Senator Sikkema is certainly right, and there's a couple other factors. One, of course, is term limits. It's interesting, it's an odd person to quote in this context, but the new Pope Francis, the other day said that when, in a long interview, that when he was 36 years old and first became a bishop, he was too authoritarian. He was too doctrinaire, and he became more moderate as he got older. And I think that happened. I've certainly seen that. I'm sure the senator's seen it even more with people in the legislature and people in Congress, but now they can't stay as long as they used to. And also, what the senator alluded to, gerrymandering, means that so few of the legislators are in swing districts, and for them, the only real election is in the primary.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because, you know, we've had redistricting and or gerrymandering, concentrating party power. That's been around since the founding of the Republic. Has that had a greater role in political divide in recent decades? And if so, how? Is it because of computerization or what's the deal? Ken?
Well, a couple of thoughts. One is I do think the country is polarized today. The country is, and I think the electorate is. I also think that term limits has played a role, at least in Michigan, in terms of the polarization of the parties because, and I can only speak through experience about the Republican Party, but what happens with term limits is you have more frequent elections. You can only serve 6 years in the House, and primaries tend to elect the more conservative members of the Republican Party in the caucus. So I think term limits in Michigan is actually sort of resulting in a more polarized legislature.
I guess it's because they lose that experience of having to deal with long-term issues because at most they're going to be in 6 or 8 years.
Well, it's just that after 6 years in the House or 8 years in the Senate, there's a new election. And so in these districts that are not swing districts, that are just going to be Republican, you're going to tend to elect more conservative members over a period of time. And I speak from some experience. When I was first elected in 1986, there were five new freshman Republicans, I being one, and I was pro-life, but three of them were actually pro-choice. Well, you can't get elected in a Republican primary today if you're pro-choice.
Are we seeing, Jack, the Democrats move as far left as the Republicans seem to have moved far right?
No, I don't think so. It's sort of odd. You know, Will Rogers said he was a member of no organized party. He was a Democrat. The Democratic Party has always been collections of different constituencies. I mean, there's certainly the minority constituencies, the African-Americans in Detroit. There's sort of what you used to call the more limousine liberal types, academic types, people in places like Ann Arbor and East Lansing. And I don't know that they've really changed that much. The Democratic Party certainly moved back towards the center about the time of Bill Clinton after being clobbered repeatedly in the 1980s. But since the Democrats are in the minority position, especially in the state Senate, I don't think there are enough of them, and they're not governing, so we really can't make that many observations about them. Although I'm not sure, I agree with everything Senator Sikkema said, except about I'm not sure that the country is more polarized. We talk that way. People who shout the loudest seem to be, but when you look at election patterns, you know, there's an old conservative economist named Jude Winiski, and he said the thing is that the voters want chicken, and you have one party offering them goose and the other duck, and they have to figure out which is more like chicken. But if you see, if you look at like the last presidential election, elections for Congress, people seem to be pretty closely to evenly divided.
I wonder how much the left-leaning MSNBC and the right-leaning Fox News, as well as the explosion of political talk radio over the last couple of decades, have influenced political polarization and my argument is the demise of the moderate politician.
Well, I think the sort of polarization of the media, as you described it, certainly doesn't help. You know, people tend to watch a certain show or a certain network and can sort of reinforce their own beliefs. I think from my standpoint, if you look at the Republican Party, and a lot of the challenges are in that party because of the Tea Party influence, but the Republican Party has always had tension between the more conservative element and then everybody else. But everybody sort of tolerated everybody else. And I think what's new today is the notion that if you're not with me 100% of the time on every single issue, big and small, you don't have the right to call yourself a Republican. That's what's new in the Republican Party today, this inability to recognize that just because somebody doesn't agree with you on every single issue, you can still be a Republican. And I think that's the phenomenon that's different than it used to be.
Jack, do you think media have had any influence on this this disappearance of the moderate?
Well, I definitely do, and I think that it's a turning away from news and a balanced approach. Now, doing news is expensive, and it's hard, and it takes a long time. It's relatively cheap for the networks to put a conservative and a liberal in two chairs and have them yell and throw food at each other. That's very entertaining, and it generates a lot of heat, but nobody's going to learn anything. So, sure, and I think we ought to try to get ourselves out of our comfort zones. But liberals ought to watch Fox more, and conservatives should watch MSNBC or you know, whatever else. But we sort of had the disappearance of the standard good old attempt at being balanced news show, and I think that has sort of hurt things.
Ken, you talked about what does it take these days to be called a Republican. We've all heard the Republican Party Tea Party faction, and then those they call RINOs, Republicans in name only. Are we creating a situation here described as a circular firing squad? Is it really hurting the Republican Party that much?
Oh, absolutely, it's hurting the Republican Party. And your description of the firing squad organized in a circle is an accurate and apt one. In fact, years ago, Republicans used to describe Democratic primaries that way. But now it's a way to describe Republican primaries. But yes, I do think it hurts the party. I think the loss of diversity, at some point, you pay the price politically. Now, gerrymandering, I think, and the ability to draw these legislative lines that Republicans had after the 2010 election, not only in Michigan, but nationally primarily, in most states, I mean, has somewhat insulated the party from this loss of diversity. But I think over time we're going to pay a price for it.
I want to talk about, because we brought up term limits, we brought up some of these other things, but the thing we keep going back to is redistricting. And there are some states like Iowa that attempt to take politics out of redistricting. Do you think that could work in Michigan?
I'm not a fan of that at all. I don't. It's been tried in a limited number of states. I haven't been impressed with the results. I don't really think it's going to make that much of a difference. I know there are people who are going to disagree with me. I'd be interested in Jack's thought about it. But
I believe that Ken is about 1 month older than me, and so he's an old cynic, and I'm a young, fresh-faced idealist. I agree that some of these things haven't worked, but it seems to me you could come up with a way of having a somewhat balanced or a fairly balanced way of apportioning that, it might be 55-45, but it wouldn't be the sort of bizarre sort of all-or-nothing thing we had. Now, in the old days, a lot of redistricting was done to protect incumbents rather than partisanship. Some partisanship, but mainly incumbents. But I think we could come up with a better system than we have now, and if we put some good minds to it, involved some demographers, I think we could probably do better.
That's Jack Lessenberry. He's Michigan Radio's political analyst. We've also been hearing from Ken Sekema. He's senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zarini Zoe Clark. Stateside was engineered today by Peggy Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.